and 8 in Stornoway. Now, as we head through into Friday, it is going to be another cold day with a strong wind, particularly in the south. But during the weekend, it turns slowly less cold and more in the way of sunshine. Next week, properly milder, but unfortunately more unsettled too. Well, that's all for now. It's back to Chris Aldridge.
Thank you, Ben. Now on BBC Radio 4, it's our book of the week. The Love and Wars of Lina Prokofiev by Simon Morrison tells the extraordinary story of the wife of the famous Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev. In the late 1920s, Lina is settled in Paris and now the mother of two sons. But everything is about to change as the Soviet regime sets out to lure Sergei home. The reader is Sean Thomas.
Relocating to the Soviet Union was a protracted process, and for Lina, a lonely one. Moscow was intimidating. But for Sergei, the magnetic pull of the Soviet Union increased, even as the wisdom of the decision came into question. His 1927 visit to Moscow, Leningrad, and Ukraine was a success. The positive memories of the trip erased what he knew of the defects of the Soviet system. The formal effort to bring him back, which was motivated by a Central Committee decree in 1925, took time to succeed. Sergei hesitated about permanently relocating to the USSR until it became obvious that he could not expect to receive commission after commission for Soviet-themed operas, ballets, film scores and theatre music without shifting his sphere of operations from Paris to Moscow. He gushed about the friendliness and general success of his visits to Moscow in 1933 and 1934 in letters to Lina back in Paris. Their thoughts about relocating are not preserved in their letters, but they discussed the matter on the telephone. Twice in 1934, Sergei called Lina from Leningrad, but the line was deliberately disconnected in the middle of the conversation. Operators made a point of allowing them to talk when the connection was poor, but interrupted them when it became clearer. Such experiences made Lina uneasy, but Sergei felt secure, extremely so. Perhaps he could musically bridge the West and the East, perhaps fame in the USSR, where Stravinsky and Rachmaninoff feared to tread, would enhance his celebrity in France and the United States. Once, while Sergei had Lina on the line, he managed to tell her he had been feted at the Kremlin. He heard that Stalin had referred to him as our Prokofiev. The endorsement engendered tragic confidence. Sergei sold his wife on the future that had been sold to him. As part of the recruitment effort, Sergei was invited to the USSR in March 1935, to present 7 concerts in 8 days in Siberia. He performed in factories as part of educational outreach programs for labourers. Lina heard little from him and suffered through his silence that summer, which he spent on the grounds of the estate of Pulyanova, the summer retreat of the artists of the Bolshoi Theatre. The private accommodations at Pulyanova had been offered to him by the Bolshoi's business manager, a former Red Army official named Vladimir Mutnik, who had contracted Sergei to compose the ballet Romeo and Juliet. The surrounding fields, forest and river proved inspiring, and the recreation, morning swimming and raft diving, tennis, and games of catch with the dancers, a chess match or stroll in the evening, calmed the composer's nerves. Lina remained in Paris, dealing with her mother and children. The search for another less expensive apartment that could house her mother after the relocation to Moscow, the selling of Sergei's latest automobile. Then Lina made an extended trip to the USSR. On the 31st of July, 1935, she left Paris, tucking into a suitcase the opera arias that she planned to perform on Soviet radio. She travelled by train with her two sons, Sviatoslav then 11, remembered pillow fights and games of hide-and-seek with Oleg, aged 7, in a deserted first-class carriage. After her arrival, the family spent just 36 hours together before Sergei left for the Caucasus for 3 weeks. Lena's mood was understandably sour. They had been apart for 3 months, and now here she was in Russia, on her own again. She complained in a telegram sent to her husband in Azerbaijan. Bathhouse or prison cell. Children out of control, exhausted. Kisses. Hurry back. Heeding Sergei's counsel, Lena kept up the pressure on the authorities for an apartment. She returned to Paris in February 1936, where things moved very fast. Meanwhile, Sergei was commissioned for one prestigious score after another. Besides the Romeo and Juliet, there was the cantata for the 20th anniversary of October for the Radio Committee, Peter and the Wolf for the Moscow Children's Theatre, incidental music for Boris Godunov and Eugene Onegin. These projects made Sergei feel euphoric, as if he could conquer time and space. Back in Paris, Lena filed the family's intention of leaving. In May, she arrived in Moscow with her sons. The following month, finally, the family was assigned an apartment in an 8-story building with 13 entrances. Sergei received a piano as a gift from the August Förster firm of Saxony, in hopes that he would advertise the instrument to colleagues in the Soviet Union. Lena never met Stalin, but she saw him once at the Moscow Conservatoire. She and Sergei were sitting in the 5th row, near the loge reserved for officials. A woman sitting next to Lena cautioned her not to look. Of course, Lena looked, and according to Sergei's diary, she locked eyes with Stalin, who had just then entered. His look was so piercing that she flinched. Lena did not directly experience the repressions that began in 1936 and peaked in 1938, the year of the Great Terror, but she was aware of the arrests, blacklistings, deportations, and executions. The Kremlin launched a propaganda campaign dedicated to eradicating the threat posed by enemies of the people. And the newspapers and radio reported the confessions that came from the hysterical show trials. Lena read these reports and indulged the fiction that the repressions were justified. The alternative was too heinous to contemplate. In Paris, practical matters had exasperated Lena. In Moscow, she found herself overwhelmed by bureaucracies and an opaque patronage system. In an affront to socialist principle, people holding senior positions in the Communist Party and the government received perks for themselves and their families, from choice apartments and summer houses to special hospitals and exclusive spas. Foreign travel was the greatest liberty, but also posed the biggest risk, as contacts with foreigners were monitored, transcribed, and scrutinized. For a few months, the promises that had lured the Prokofievs to Moscow were kept. But then, inexorably, they began to be broken. One of the setbacks consigned his cantata for the 20th anniversary of October to the dustbin. Seeking to establish his political credentials, Sergei composed a score featuring double mixed chorus, orchestra, accordion band, military band, and musique concrète, a siren, an alarm bell, recorded speech, and marching feet. But the work had no chance of success, because Sergei decided, for musical reasons, to alter the political speeches at the heart of the libretto. Tampering with Lenin's words was akin to burning the Bible, absolutely taboo. The work was banned. The waste of the cantata was heartbreaking, as were the endless demands to revise his ballet, Romeo and Juliet, which eventually became the greatest success of his career in the Soviet Union, but not until it had endured 5 years of tampering. The scenario of the first draft revised Shakespeare's ending. Instead of committing accidental double suicide, the two lovers escape into a star-filled elsewhere to live out their love. The change was inspired by Sergei's belief in Christian Science, which speaks of the immortality of the spirit. Yet even before the music was complete, forces had begun to align themselves against Romeo and Juliet. The rhythmic writing was criticized for its irregularity, the harmonic and melodic writing for its anti-romantic rationalism. The premiere was put off for 1 year. Then the choreographer, Leonid Lavrovsky, demanded so many changes from the composer that the two nearly came to blows. Sergei defended his ballet, but lost. The happy ending was sacrificed for the familiar tragic one. Solo variations and group dances were added, and the orchestration thickened by hack composers without Sergei's permission. The criticism of the plot actually proved trifling, however, when Vladimir Mutnik, the official who had commissioned the ballet, was arrested as part of a purge within cultural circles. His name had appeared on an incarceration and interrogation list, initialled by Stalin. He was executed by firing squad on the 11th of November. For Lina, this was a moment of realization. They had been deceived. The move to Moscow had been a mistake. For Sergei, frustration became despair, then devastation. By the time Romeo and Juliet was premiered in 1940 in Leningrad, during the brief Soviet-Finnish Winter War, his spirit had been broken. He would continue to compose brilliantly, but only in a way mindful of political imperatives. Lina knew he had been forever changed, that a fog of fear hung over their lives. Soon the purges began to touch the lives of the Prokofievs. Acquaintances on the first floor of their building were taken into custody. The arrest would have gone unnoticed, except for the sound of footsteps and muffled shouting in the corridor. Lina suffered from insomnia. "Why don't you sleep?" Sergei asked. She whispered, "I'm frightened." She reminded him that he had promised they could leave if need be. His answer, "What I promised then can't be done now." Yet they were still able to travel, at least for the first 2 years, and in 1937 Lina joined Sergei on his tour to the West. The children remained in Moscow, thus ensuring their parents' return at the end of the tour. Regular reports on their activities were submitted to Moscow from the Soviet embassies in Paris, London, and Washington. They were no longer free, either at home or abroad. Then it was back to Moscow. Now the door was closing on them. Having moved to Moscow together, they started moving apart, each suffering the peculiar stresses of life in the Soviet Union. Whenever they were in the same place, they argued and fought, and Lina was often in tears. In 1938, Prokofiev exchanged his external passport for his internal one. The internationally acclaimed composer was then declared ineligible for travel.
At the same time tomorrow, Sean Thomas continues reading The Love and Wars of Lina Prokofiev by Simon Morrison. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer, Elizabeth Allard. Thank you. sailing by. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday the 4th of April. There are warnings of gales in Thames, Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Trafalgar and Fitzroy. The general synopsis at 1800. Low just west of North Trafalgar, 987, expected South Trafalgar, 998, by 1800 Thursday. New lows expected France, 1000.